something in the work of the Lord. And I want you to think about Vikings at the Battle of Maldon. It was 991 AD, and the Viking Olaf Tryggvason sailed his ship up the Blackwater River into the tidal pools near Essex, England. Here is an aerial shot of this battlefield. The Vikings stationed themselves on the island, and the English were on the kind of above these marshes. They were on the northern end here of this battlefield. What was unique about this battlefield is that these tidal pools, of course, rose and fell with the tides. And so the Vikings, while they were on the island, were shouting threats at the English. They were hurling spears. They were shooting arrows. There were all of these horrible things going on because they were in a deadlock and a standoff until the tide would recede and it would get shallow enough for them to go about the 100 yards across those tidal pools. When we study the Battle of Maldon, this is the earliest English record of the word steadfast. And steadfast is the term that was used to describe the English soldiers that were standing shoulder to shoulder, shields up, in the face of everything the Vikings could hurl at them. And it is a poem called The Battle of Maldon that speaks of them in those very steadfast terms. Isn't that what Jesus showed us and calls us towards? To be shoulder to shoulder, shields up, unwilling to yield even an inch. Today, there is a statue here that is commemorating those steadfast and very brave soldiers that were defending their homes and their families from this Viking attack. And Merriam-Webster's dictionary puts it this way: ever since the use of the word steadfast, 1,029 years ago, these are the qualities that are associated with this word. It's used to describe those who are unswerving in loyalty, faith, or friendship. It implies a steady, unwavering course of love, allegiance, or conviction. Look at those six highlighted words there. Don't every one of those describe Jesus? That He has been loyal to us and to the Father. That He has shown us the walk of faith. That He's become our greatest friend, giving His life for us. That He inspires our love, our allegiance, our conviction in the things of the gospel. We have this incredible concept of being steadfast this morning. And if you're impressed with the English definition, I just got to go and tell you, the Greek definition gets even better. This is such a rich, rich word. And we have set our course, just as they set their course, we have set our course to be steadfast, to grow in this rich text from 1 Corinthians and chapter 15. What we see in chapter 15 is that there's this Greek word that's only used three times in the entire New Testament. Now, in our English translations, the word steadfast is all over the place. But the particular word for steadfast that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, it's hedrias. It's only used these three times. And I ask you to take your Bibles to Colossians chapter 1 because I want you to see the other two occurrences. Colossians chapter 1, verse 23. He says, "If indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made a minister." You can see that the idea of being steadfast in faith is emphasized in this verse. You've been given this faith and you continue in it. You remain. You be steadfast. But even in this context, being steadfast in faith is connected to the hope of the gospel that's been proclaimed. And it's very, very similar in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that we're called to be steadfast, to be immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. And you can be steadfast because it's connected to the faith that was proclaimed, like chapter 15, verse 1 through 8, and this great hope we have of our resurrection. So the context in these two passages is extremely similar. The only other time this Greek word hedraios is used is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, if you want to come back to that book. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 37. Here Paul is describing someone steadfast, not just in their faith, in their things of the Scriptures, but they're steadfast in their own determination, in the purposes that they have. In verse 37, he's describing someone that has decided not to get married in view of the present distress. So he says, verse 37, he who stands firm in his heart, or is steadfast in his heart. It gives this idea again of great purpose that they are acting with. So understand that. We're going to be steadfast. We're going to have these qualities of loyalty and friendship, though that's qualities of not giving an inch. And that's especially true in the faith we put in the gospel and in our purpose to serve and glorify God, to be pleasing to Him. You take that a little step further. That's the context of this word. The actual Greek definition of it literally means to sit. Like to put your full weight. When we sit down in a chair, we trust the legs of that chair and we put our full weight in that position. So this word, hedraios, is literally just to sit. Because once somebody sits down, like it's hard to move them, right? If somebody's sitting down and you're trying to pick them up or move them, it gets way more difficult. In English, we use this word homestead, right? To describe the land that you have, your homestead. Or you might say you fastened your seatbelt. You've locked your seatbelt into place to put homestead and fasten together. That's where we get steadfast. It's a place in which you are firmly fixed. And when you sit down, that's the place in which you are firmly fixed. You guys know me well enough that my brain is going to go to construction from my dad. So this is what I think of. Those big concrete blocks that are interlocking. You know, sometimes we use those little interlocking blocks for our landscaping in the suburbs. But think about those big, heavy concrete blocks that are interlocking. Once you sit that down, you're not picking that back up. Haven't you ever helped somebody move and maybe they have the dreaded sleeper sofa? And you go, where does this thing go? Boom, right there. That's where it goes because I'm not picking it up again. Once you sit this down, it's locked in. It's not moving. And this Greek word that Paul is using, these three times, he says, you're locked in. You're not going forward, backward, side to side. You have set here in your faith and in your purpose, which is grounded in the gospel and has the hope of the resurrection in view. God, that's just really neat. It's really great to see the way that we are set there. We'll talk more about some of the other passages where Paul uses this idea of standing firm. And there is this concept of like being in a position upright. But this text, our theme for the year, is about where you sit. What is your fixed position in faith and in purpose? So what does that really look like in the New Testament? Well, I think we need to go back to Jesus. And we can think about maybe the most famous description of sitting down in any of Jesus' teachings in Luke chapter 14, verse 7 through 11. And I do want to come back and read this together. Luke 14, verse 7 through 11. Remember this great parable where he's telling us, you pick a humble spot, don't go and rush to the front. Luke chapter 14, let's begin reading in verse 7. He began speaking a parable to the invited guest when he noticed how they had been picking out places of honor at the table. And he said, when you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both will come to you and say, give your place to this man. Then in disgrace, you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. And then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. You understand that what Jesus is talking about in this parable is make a choice and do it with both humility and wisdom, right? Have enough humility not to rush to the front and enough wisdom to understand that there may be other guests still arriving. And even if you feel like this is just your close buddy, your best friend, you don't know who else is coming. There may be someone else. You can see on the screen here, Jesus expects something about this choice. There's a conscious consideration of the options. And after looking and considering those options, then there is a purposeful choice both made intellectually and acted upon. And when you make that consideration and you make that choice, it's not being motivated by your own glory. It's actually being motivated by morality. It's being motivated by the kind of character that you're expected to have. Because those same features come to play in where we sit, where we are steadfast, shoulder to shoulder, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 58. Let me kind of put it out this way. Think about a marriage for a moment. With these choices, ideally, this choice, this being steadfast, it begins with a recognition of facts and a determination to respond accordingly. That's what Jesus is saying. Hey, recognize there's a lot of seats and someone else may have the seat of honor today. So once you see those facts, you respond accordingly. When you're dating, you go, wait a minute, this is the one, right? Like, I love this person more than I've loved anyone in my whole life. This is the one. There's a recognition of facts and you respond accordingly, right? You're down on one knee. Will you? And ideally, you see that and you act. And after you act, after you get married, then that marriage is maintained with honor and devotion, not regretful obligation. So let's take it outside of marriage. Let's go back to our soldiers from Essex, England, standing with their shields in the face of the Vikings. Ideally, there's a recognition of the facts. Our families and our home are in grave danger. And we must respond accordingly. We must pick up our shields. We must go to those front lines. And we must defend our children and our families. And when they are there and the Vikings start shouting and the Vikings start shooting the arrows, why do you stay? Do you stay only because it's a regretful obligation, or do you stay because of honor and devotion? That you've made a vow to defend this family and you're going to do everything in your power to protect those that you love and care about. Do you get this? So in Luke chapter 14, it is a recognition, there's a conscious consideration, a purposeful choice, a moral motivation. You've seen it with soldiers. You've seen it in marriage. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Because what we need to ask ourselves is, what are we expected to recognize that would inspire this kind of steadfastness? What are we supposed to really be anchored into that would cause us to behave as steadfast, immovable people, always abounding in the work of the Lord? I would tell you, I believe in this chapter, it is the certain victory of Christ. Just back up with me to verse 55. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin. The power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord. There is so much joy in this passage. That knowing what Christ has accomplished, we have this great certainty of our victory. And so verse 58 becomes this awesome picture of what we can become. Now look, if we're just soldiers fighting against Vikings, maybe we would say to ourselves, I don't know what's going to determine how steadfast I am there. Because as soon as the dude next to me gets hit with a spear or an arrow, I'm kind of shaking in my boots here. We might be tempted to say that how steadfast we are depends on our personality, right? Like those that are like just iron-willed and stubborn people by nature, they will hold their shield up. I got to tell you, it doesn't depend on personality. It depends on the certainty of our victory. It depends on what Christ has already accomplished. It depends on the shield that He has given us. Every one of us, regardless of background or of personality, even regardless of the threats that are being hurled at us, we can all be steadfast and immovable. When we think about what this takes, the whole chapter builds us towards this. And I can't steal from Russ's lesson next month, but hopefully this slide will set that sermon up, because next month he's going to go through the chapter kind of section by section. But think of these Christians and what they need to actually be steadfast. They need to be fully convinced of the truth and value of the gospel. Just like the soldiers, fully convinced of the truth of this threat and the value of their families. When you're fully convinced of the truth and the value of the gospel, you stand and you don't back down. When you accept the possibility of all difficulties, even death, you can stand. This is not some little naive, oh great, we can all be steadfast. No, this is, there are real threats. There are Vikings. This is a battle. And once I understand that even in death, with Christ I have victory, then the power of death is gone. When I know that I'm not alone, even when others are not present. How could Daniel be so steadfast in the face of the lion's den? Well, he was alone, but not really alone. How could Paul, when he says everyone was forsaking him, how could he be steadfast? Well, because he wasn't really alone. Like Elijah, who found out that 7,000 had not bowed their knees to Baal. We remember we're not alone, even if others are not immediately present. And I just think of those soldiers who were shoulder to shoulder. They were not alone in this battle. And when we're told that this is for us as brethren, beloved brethren, we're not alone in this. They've determined not to give up or retreat from their confession of both loyalty and sacrifice. Look over at 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 12 for just a moment. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 12, as Paul is equipping Timothy to live with this steadfast spirit, to be immovable and abounding in the work of the Lord. Notice his point about confession. Chapter 6 and verse 12. Fight the good fight of faith. Take hold of the eternal life to which you were called, and you made the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. Like a soldier who says, I'll go. They need to not back down. Timothy has said, I'll go. I'll fight the good fight. And Paul's saying, remember that you confessed this. Remember that you put your faith here. You volunteered for this. So serve with loyalty and sacrifice, not just a grudging obligation. And as we've said, we view our coming victory with real and meaningful hope. The reason those soldiers fought was for the great hope that they had in protecting and preserving their homes and families. Can I let you know that any time you're around a steadfast Christian, it is literally a life-changing blessing. It is steadfast Christians that are the kind of leaders who do not compromise with sin, regardless of what the rest of the world is doing. It's these kind of steadfast Christians that are our friends. They don't ignore us when we're burdened and when we're struggling. They see our struggle and they come alongside us. It's steadfast Christians that are an example who inspire our faithfulness. And guys, steadfastness is just the beginning. So my assignment this morning was to come to verse 58 and just to walk through the key phrases. I put about 70% on steadfast. Let me give you like 30% on the other phrases. Did you notice in the English definitions that we put up at the beginning, and go back and download the slides, that the words used to describe steadfastness were, you know, faith and loyalty and friendship, but it was unwavering in those qualities or unswerving in those qualities. Usually when we want to amplify the meaning of steadfastness, we use a negative term next to it. And that's exactly what Paul does with immovable. You're steadfast. You've taken your position and you're not moved from that. You're unswerving, you're unwavering, you're immovable. This Greek word here is literally just the negative form of to move away. Maintaining this steadfastness, not just in principle, not maintaining steadfastness just because it's an individual character quality in absence of other circumstances. You're actually steadfast when under great pressure. That's the emphasis of immovable. So when he says, be steadfast, he's defining what to be. And immovable is exercise that steadfastness no matter what pressures come. Chapter 15 has a lot of pressure in it. There were a lot of things going on at Corinth. Again, it's my job not to steal from the next lesson. But look, there's a lot of pressures happening in that chapter. And part of the great strength of our theme for this year is being able to identify with those. The kind of pressures, the kind of difficulties that the Corinthians were facing are so similar to what we're challenged with in our life today. And so we're trying to be steadfast despite that pressure. also we want to be always abounding in the work. Always mentions frequency, right? I'm constantly abounding in this work. And how much? Well, I'm overflowing. I'm not just doing a little bit. I'm not just doing enough to get by. I'm not just doing enough to avoid getting disfellowshipped or, in my case, getting fired. No, we're not looking for bare minimums here. It's always overflowing and giving ourselves diligently to this. He's describing it as the work of the Lord, not like the sit back and watch of the Lord, the work of the Lord. Let me read Barnes' notes on this. I'm certain I'll try to put this in a future sermon as well. It's pretty short, but listen how rich. Always abounding, always engaged in doing the will of God, in promoting His glory, advancing His kingdom. The phrase means not only to be engaged in this, but to be engaged diligently and laboriously, excelling in this. The work of the Lord here means that which the Lord requires, all the appropriate duties of Christians. Paul exhorts them to practice every Christian virtue and to do all that they could to further the gospel among people. It's just a great and concise quote. To always be abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing your toil is not in vain. I mentioned the threats that are described in chapter 15. Every single one of these threats have a common foundation, which is go ahead and give up now. Right? Like if there's no resurrection, then just go ahead and give up now. And if Jesus is not really worthy, then just go ahead and give up now. And if death is the end of everything, then just go ahead and give up now. All of the evil influences of chapter 15 are trying to convince us that living and being steadfast is vain. And the conclusion of Paul is, I have taken out every single one of those objections, every single one of those arguments. You can know for certain this is not a waste of time. This is not a waste of your life. This is not in vain. Because I am so pumped about the theme for this year. That we can be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that it's not in vain. This morning we're just having the overview of the verse, introducing what an amazing concept this is. Next month, Russ will take us through step by step each section of chapter 15. And then we'll go back and we'll take those individual sections and we're looking at these 12 lessons as a pathway towards becoming, towards developing this. We know we're not there at the moment. We all want to grow in these qualities. So we'll deal with that gospel and that sound doctrine where we plant our feet. We will deal with those pressures against us, immovable in the face of false teachings and temptations and evil companions and skepticism. We'll look a little bit at Paul himself and how is he able to be steadfast? Because like we said, it's not based on personality. Paul was not steadfast just because he was like some Superman. He specifically says in this chapter, he was able to be steadfast because of the grace of God, how he depended on God's grace and God's strength. And then we'll wind this series up with abounding in the work of the Lord, both together and personally, knowing that our labor is not in vain. Accompanying these lessons will be a congregational reading plan. We've picked out 52 chapters. It'll be one chapter per week. There are copies of this on the table in the back, and I'll be emailing out a copy to everybody today. There's not even enough copies, so don't worry about it here. But I will be sending that out today. We'll be talking about that more. We'll have weekly reading. You'll have an assignment even beginning for this week in John chapter 20. As we look at this, we said in our kickoff that there's some great blessings here. This is a theme that's going to bring honor to God. Because He's the one that allows us to be so steadfast. This is something that should bring greater stability to our lives. That we're not kicked around and pushed around by pressures, but instead find that grounding in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. It gives us great hope. Even Colossians chapter 1 and 1 Corinthians 15 are both pulling out this concept of hope. It gives us success in our battles. The way that Paul diffuses every attack from the enemy in chapter 15 are things for us, and it gives us encouragement in our works, knowing that our labor is not in vain. I thank you so much for your attention this morning, and I hope that you are going to be interested in growing in each of these qualities. It may be that you're sitting there thinking to yourself, I've been anything but steadfast. I didn't hold my shield up. In fact, I almost joined the enemy. I've been listening to his commands. I've been following his orders. I've compromised my devotion to the Lord. If that's where you are, we want to come alongside you, build you back up, and get you both forgiven by the Lord's grace, but back into service to be abounding in the Lord's work. And if you haven't begun this walk with him, if you haven't seen the great hope and victory that's in Jesus, and you want to begin today by confessing your faith and being buried with Christ in baptism, we would invite you at this time to come forward as we stand and sing.